Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Quick reminder and invitation. I will be back tonight at 8 o'clock with episode 3 of our Wednesday night series, 4 graduations and a wedding, because you can't have graduation commencement exercises and can't have wedding receptions. We're providing some on the radio. And our graduation exercises with your calls, graduates, to get your radio diplomas tonight will be for people who want to go into public policy work. And we have two very special guests. Andrew Yang is going to give a commencement address, and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is going to take graduates' calls. So we have Andrew Yang, we have AOC, and 2020 graduates at any level of school, if you want to go into public policy, work of any kind, government, activism, whatever, come and join us and call in and talk to them and get your radio diploma. That's tonight at 8 o'clock here on WNYC. With me now, Dr. Derek Kass, emergency medicine physician at the Columbia University Medical Center and a Yahoo News medical contributor. She's been commenting on how to reopen things in the right ways, schools, camps, colleges, bars, now that reopenings are beginning in all 50 states. And of course, she's on the front lines being in the emergency department at a major New York hospital. So we'll talk about that too. Dr. Kass, thanks so much for coming on with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm actually looking forward to tonight. That sounds like a great commencement event.
Yeah, well, come join us. You can crash the gates. You told a story on Yahoo News about one infected person at rehearsal in a choir and what a new study found happened with that person. Can you start with that story?
Yeah, so actually this was published by the CDC Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, which is they looked back at, you know, the gatherings that had happened in March in Seattle and tried to track and trace cases to figure out if they could find the patient zero for an outbreak. And in this case, what they found was that there was a chorus practice at a church, and this group had practiced on March 3rd and March 10th, 7 days apart. It was a weekly practice. And they realized that somebody in the group had gotten infected probably March 7th was when their symptoms started. And so the group that practiced together March 10th, of that group that had over 60 people, 52 of them actually wound up getting symptomatic and or testing positive for the coronavirus. And one of the extrapolations from this was that not only are gatherings, obviously you can see the exponential growth of the disease transmission in small gatherings, but certain activities, specifically singing in small groups, you know, moving the chairs, eating communally, all the things you do at a church-based or community gathering could not necessarily be the first places we would open, because we can see that there are certain behaviors that are higher risk than others, even when you're in the same number of space, in the same number of people in a space. So I think what we learned from that particular study was, you know, one asymptomatic individual eventually and probably infected over 50 people. It's why we keep the numbers down, but also that two of those people unfortunately passed away. And so there, even if the, you know, 50 of the people were able to recover safely at home and not have to get hospitalized, eventually the disease does get to people that can't fight it off and may actually pass away. And so that's a lot of the reason why we make sure that we gather smartly and slowly in small groups as we start to reopen.
And you link that to your opinion about what kinds of businesses should we open first. Frankly, you say bars, not so much. And you say lower contact, lower risk businesses should be the first to open. What are some examples of such businesses?
So I think that, you know, lower contact, so maybe a local store that you could have foot traffic be slow, where you know you can ask for mask wearing, where it's actually helping the local economy. You know, you can actually open certain manufacturing plants as long as the guidance is about testing and tracing, making sure the proper PPE, the protective equipment, is being given to all of the employees and that they're being supported if they do get sick. I think it's really going to be a local governance issue to decide what the investment is, but these are invested openings. You know, one of the things I was talking to friends yesterday about bars opening is not as much about the bars, which is obviously important, but that maybe we shouldn't even play music at bars. Because if people are going to gather and drink, they have to speak louder and closer if there's music in the background, right? And so even that step of holding music off if a bar chooses to open or asking the patrons to ask them to turn the music down would contribute to a decrease in disease transmission. And we just need to get granular in how we move in space and understanding the risks that each of those activities poses to us individually.
You mentioned something to my producer this morning about summer camps. Were you talking about day camps or sleepaway camps?
Well, I was reviewing the newest CDC guidelines that came out in the middle of the night, actually. And what they did was they were talking about day camps per se and whether or not they could and should open and then what it would look like. They actually didn't even mention overnight camps. And I think what it allows us to figure out is if we're going to advance from no gathering to any gatherings, we need to start slowly and deliberately and be able to undo the things that we do every single time. And that it may seem, based on the CDC guidelines and actually an executive order from the Connecticut governor yesterday, that it seems like overnight camps just may be too many steps too far at this point in the opening guidelines.
How about the sleepaway camps known as colleges?
So that's a really good point, right? Because this morning I was watching the president of the University of Miami speak about how he would open slowly and deliberately. And before this, apparently, he was actually the health minister for the country of Mexico. So I think he has a pretty good informed idea of how to start slowly. And I think it's going to come back to investing in testing, understanding the capacity to gather, starting slowly, being able to move both forwards and backwards. I'm optimistic that in September, we'll be able to gather for education in some way, whether it's, you know, innovative ways to gather for a couple of hours a day in schools and then do the rest on Zoom. So you can stagger the openings and you can keep kids really far apart and you can watch them closely. As a parent of three kids, one of the things I think about a lot is how infrequently my children listen to me about the advice about how to engage once they're not under my thumb.
Really? I'm sure that makes you unique if your kids don't always listen to you.
So I do wonder about if our kids are being, you know, put in school or even in camps and are, as parents, we're not there to oversee the retraining of their gathering, right? That a lot of this may be us being more and more involved in them understanding their responsibility in engaging with other kids when they see them for the first time. You know, I think that these are all the things that we need to think about as we advance to schools and colleges and education programs and, you know, community-based, faith-based organizations. All of these are places we want to get to, but we want to get there in the right fashion.
Do you have an opinion about sports? Like, various pro sports are looking at restarting without fans. Do you see a way they can play baseball or basketball or soccer, which apparently might be the first ones back, as close as players have to get to one another?
You know, it's funny. My husband and I were talking about this the other day because thinking about things like NASCAR and tennis and golf, which are not the ones you were talking about, seem to me much more natural beginnings because they're individual sports that are really socially distanced by their actual sport. Whereas baseball and football and soccer, you come into contact with individuals. How do you keep, is it flag football that we open with as opposed to contact football? So I don't know. I think it'll come down to the players and the owners coming together and an understanding of risk and of, you know, testing and the economics of what it looks like. I think that if the community decides to invest in a sport and the players feel that their risks are being mitigated, it's possible. But I think these have to be very transparent conversations about where we are and what it means to engage and contact other people and what that risk means individually.
Wouldn't they have to test every player every day? Apparently that's not what they're planning for the team sports. But why wouldn't they have to test every player every day and all the other workers?
So that's a good question. I think we don't know the answers to this. There's no perfect gold standard. It's the reason, back to the CDC guidelines, why we have been encouraged by seeing some metrics finally come out from the CDC on what it would look like to be a responsible business owner and manager. I think that testing every single day, it depends on how many people that it is. If it's 10 or 20, that may be possible. If it's 300 or 400, that becomes more cumbersome. But we want to make sure that we're not using false hope, right? So we're not saying if we temperature check every day, that's the same thing as actually doing antigen testing every day. So I don't know. Maybe it's only every day they play, not every day that they are in session. I don't know. Football is a once a week activity, last time I checked, when it comes to the sport. But the practices happen, you know, all over the week. So I think this is going to have to be advised by public health professionals. I think that we're going to have to reasonably expect that the precautions we put in actually do protect the players from getting sick, and that if they got sick, that there was, you know, measures in place to take care of them, because they are also putting themselves at risk, you know, when they are playing on those fields.
What hospital are you at, and how are things?
I work at Columbia, and I will say that across New York City, we are seeing an increase back from our nadir, our lowest level of volume, of our regular patients coming back. I think that we expect to see the patients. So we've been very, very good in New York City about the new patients coming in with symptoms of coronavirus. And that's been an indication of the work that the social distancing has happened and at what people have done at home. And it's been remarkable to see in real time. I think we're going to start seeing a little bit of more of the patients coming in across the city, especially in the communities that are harder to social distance and have been the whole time. But I am very encouraged by the work of the New Yorkers. A city like ours, which got hit so hard with a tidal wave of this disease, has responded with just such heart and empathy for each other. It's been a wonderful experience being in the middle of New York, actually, all this. You know, aside from the pandemic, the work of New Yorkers has been inspiring, to say the least.
Absolutely. And before you go, I want to get your emergency physician's perspective on the chloroquine question. And I'm always trying to depoliticize this because it's gotten
totally
Politicized. You know, the president said he's taking it. That's caused a controversy. So here's why the president said a month ago that he was supporting experimental use of the drug. It was for people as a last-ditch thing if they were close to death. Listen.
I'm seeing people dying, and I've seen people that are going to die without it. And you know the expression, when that's happening, they should do it. What really do we have to lose?
But now the data on those people have shown more harm than good. The president yesterday said this about that.
If you look at the one survey, the only bad survey, they were giving it to people that were in very bad shape. They were very old, almost dead. It was a Trump enemy statement.
So first he's promoting it specifically for people close to death. Then he's saying, oh, that's we should dismiss the studies on people who are close to death. So, you know, we know he's all over the place. But can you help clear up the actual medicine? Because this is why it matters. It's not what Trump says and just about Trump. It's that this is inspiring people around the country to do things that may or may not be safe. So are actual doctors using chloroquine for actual patients, and at what stage of disease?
So there are two medications, hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine. Hydroxychloroquine is actually the one the president was talking about over and over again, although both medications have come in and out of the media. There have been a lot of studies on the use of hydroxychloroquine, not only in the compassionate use at the end of life that he was talking about, but remember that the FDA approved that the patients who were in the hospital, the patients needed to be in the hospital or in a clinical trial in order to get the medication. And so a lot of the studies were designed for the sickest patients. Okay. I want to make sure that we understand that science is not good or bad. Studies are not good or bad. And nobody is partisan when it comes to the results of research, right? So there aren't Democratic doctors and Republican doctors giving people advice. There are doctors trying to save lives. And I think we all need to be on that page because we want to applaud good work and we want to call into question the science that isn't seeming to work out so well for patients' lives. The hydroxychloroquine studies that are out there, there are a lot of them. And one of them is actually looking at the prevention, or more importantly, people that are at high exposure, so doctors, nurses, frontline workers, taking hydroxychloroquine as a preventative measure and seeing if they do or don't actually develop the coronavirus. There's no data published on that at all, but I think that that's a lot of what happened in the last couple of weeks, because it seems like the president may have been exposed to the coronavirus in a way that made him uncomfortable or certainly closer than he was used to. And he may have known those studies were out there and decided to take it himself and insist that his doctor give it to him. And for some reason, he got it. That seems to be what happened as a prevention of getting the COVID, you know, COVID-19.
We just have 15 seconds left, but do healthcare workers, as he claims, take it as a preventive medicine measure if you're working with infected patients?
There are healthcare workers enrolled in clinical trials from the FDA taking this medication. Physicians themselves should not be taking it preventatively off-label, just like regular citizens and presidents. These are measured studies that are teaching America how to take a medication.
In clinical trials approved. Dr. Derek Kass at the Columbia University Medical Center in the Emergency Medicine Department and a Yahoo News contributor. Really good information throughout this conversation. We look forward to having you back. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.